It's over at a reasonable hour so I can mow.
Tomorrow night you're going to go too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Are you planning to go to dinner part or just cocktail on the night?
We'll do dinner.
Okay. We could do this, but these two are not ready.
I have nothing better to do.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this May 10th and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 48A. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 48A comes to you at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. This directs certain professional regulatory boards to collaborate with the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules regarding the reporting of the completion of continuing education relating to suicide prevention upon reauthorization to that practice, establishes record keeping and reporting requirements, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact. At this time, there is no amendment because it's not ready, but I'm assuming they will speak to an amendment. This left the Senate floor, 29 ayes and one excuse, Mr. Chair.
And I'm, for your information, we're going to be moving around the agenda today flexibly because we have committee members coming in and out. So don't be surprised if things don't go as in order. Madam Minister, would you call the panel, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Ann Kirkwood, Jim Rickards, and Denise Terry.
Everybody be as brief as you can today.
And then just three more after that.
Please start.
Good afternoon, Representative Greenlick,
first one.
Vice Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Ann Kirkwood, and I'm the Suicide Intervention Coordinator for the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 48. The 48-4 requires licensing boards governing certain physical and behavioral health professionals and school counselors to adopt rules to accommodate.
Sorry, it's 48-4, the 48A?
Yes. It's the A4s, Mr. Chair.
Okay. It's not a different bill. I mean, you don't have another amendment, is that right?
I don't have another amendment. Okay. I understood there was a -4, so.
Well.
It is an A4.
There is an A4.
A4.
Is an A4 pending before us?
Proposed, no.
It's proposed.
It's proposed. Oh,
right.
Okay, so.
Proposed, okay. Sorry, if I speak to it then?
Please.
Okay. So the amended bill requires licensing boards governing certain physical and behavioral health professionals and school counselors to adopt rules to accommodate voluntary continuing education in suicide risk assessment, treatment, and management. The rules would allow providers to report their completion of this voluntary coursework and have the credits applied toward their overall requirements. The bill further requires the licensing boards to provide their training statistics to OHA, and OHA in turn is required to report progress to the legislature each year as part of OHA's already required annual suicide intervention and prevention report. The bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish a list of best practice courses that providers can take toward those continuing education credits. In 2015, 762 Oregon residents died by suicide. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for Oregonians between the ages of 15 and 34. Over 2,000 state residents are hospitalized for suicide behaviors each year. In 2015, 16% of 11th graders reported seriously considering suicide in the past 12 months. This is alarming. Despite our efforts to help these young people, the youth suicide rate has been rising in Oregon each year since 2011. Unfortunately, the very people that we task with intervening and treating people contemplating suicide have little or no training in suicide assessment, management, and treatment of suicide risk. Senate Bill 48 aims to provide professionals who work with our youth and at-risk adults the skills they need to feel confident and competent to identify suicide risk and deal with high-risk situations effectively. A trained professional can intervene and address behaviors that signal someone is at risk for taking their own life. If the public expects Oregon professionals to responsibly care for suicidal adults and children, we need to give them the training and support to do that. Continuing education can fill the gap between patients' need and providers' knowledge and ensure that our state's professionals have the competence and confidence to save lives. A study published in the Journal of Suicide and Life-Threatening Behavior reported that among mental health providers, only 25% of social workers surveyed received training in suicide management and treatment in college. Only 6% of marriage and family therapists received college training. And incredibly, only 2% of accredited counselor education programs offer this training. A lack of college-level education in suicide treatment and management leaves a significant gap that continuing education can fill. Best practice training in suicide intervention, assessment, and management is widely available at low cost or no cost throughout Oregon. Web-based and community-based trainings also are available. Training for physical and behavioral health providers and school personnel is encouraged by the U.S. Surgeon General, the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention, the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention, the American Association of Suicidology, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and it is included in the Oregon Youth Suicide Intervention and Prevention Plan. Training has proven effective in preparing professionals to address the suicide crisis. A study in 13 states of 1,100 professionals who took a 7-hour training on suicide risk assessment, management, and treatment showed that only 9 to 35% passed the 25-item pretest. The pass rate increased dramatically to 95 to 100% post-training. Multiple studies have shown that up to 75% of those who die by suicide saw a primary care provider in the previous year, many of them in the previous month. Nationally, there's been an increase in negligence-based lawsuits against school systems alleging failure to respond to suicide risk. School counselor training could reduce the liability that our schools face when staff are unprepared to deal with students in crisis. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 90% of Americans who die by suicide have a treatable mental illness, substance use disorder, or both. These people are ill-served when they are referred to professionals who are unprepared to address suicide risk. In addition, best practice interventions by trained providers in our emergency departments and health systems can reduce the risk of expensive return visits by patients in another suicide crisis. The bill before you does not require behavioral and physical health providers to take these trainings. It directs the licensing boards to make training available so the behavioral and physical health care workforce may better serve the safety needs of their patients and the public. It allows the Legislative Assembly to monitor progress of the voluntary training approach. Every suicide is preventable if we know warning signs and how to respond effectively. Senate Bill 48 is the first step toward making suicide prevention in Oregon a serious priority. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Jim Rickards, the Chief Medical Officer for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to brief you on an amendment to Senate Bill 48A that OHA is working on with legislative counsel so that if and when it comes before you, you'll be familiar. In short, it adds certain healthcare professionals to the one-time pain management continuing education requirement. As you know, public health, behavioral health, health systems, academic institutions, policymakers, and law enforcement officials in Oregon are working together statewide and at the local level to reduce the risks associated with the use of opioid medications. Those efforts in particular are concerned with reducing abuse, addictions, and unintentional overdose deaths. The Oregon Pain Management Commission's role in these efforts is to ensure that all professionals responsible for assessing the needs of an individual with acute or chronic pain should have the information and confidence to treat safely and effectively individuals needing pain management. Existing statute requires 10 types of healthcare professionals to complete the Pain Management Commission's online module on pain management. These providers are physicians, physician assistants, nurses, nurse practitioners, psychologists, chiropractic and naturopathic physicians, acupuncturists, pharmacists, dentists, physical therapists, and occupational therapists. Effective management of an individual's severe and chronic pain may involve more than one healthcare provider. All professionals should share the basic pain education and speak a common pain language. While interdisciplinary pain management often begins with and is coordinated by the primary care provider, all providers should be able to recognize complex pain so they can address the whole person's needs as they relate to that pain. To ensure all professionals involved in pain management receive ongoing education, the Oregon Pain Management Commission recommends that ORS 431.590 be amended to add these 8 types of professionals to the pain education requirement. These include expanded practice dental hygienists, optometrists, clinical social workers, professional counselors, marriage and family therapists, massage therapists, speech-language pathologists, and certified alcohol and addictions counselors. Optometrists are included because Senate Bill 152, passed by the legislature in 2015, extended to optometrists the ability to prescribe opioid pain relievers for eye pain. In summary, the Commission is asking the legislature to expand the one-time pain education requirement to include the additional types of healthcare professionals who are being asked to treat patients with complex pain as we try to reduce opioid prescribing and use in Oregon. Thanks.
Did I hear podiatrists on that list?
They fall under physicians.
They fall under physicians, yeah.
The medical board.
Yeah, the medical board, yeah.
Yes, please.
Sorry. Good afternoon. My name is Denise Turay. I'm the coordinator for the Oregon Pain Management Commission, and I'm here with Dr. Rickards in this testimony just to answer any additional questions you had. So the question about the podiatrists, they are followed and regulated under the Oregon Medical Board, so they are included under physicians.
Any questions,
Mr. Chair?
Right. Okay.
Yes. I guess, Ms. Kirkwood, I was taken aback a bit by the testimony that you provided. College-educated, the vast majority of these health professionals are well graduate school or professional school graduates. So I don't quite understand the relevance of college-educated. Those people should be under supervision of some professional. So I'm at a loss to understand your testimony.
Well, for those who do complete a college education, what we're finding across the country is they're not receiving any instruction or very little instruction in how to treat patients who are suicidal and how to assess their level of risk. So if they supervise someone who doesn't go to college, the supervision obviously wouldn't include that knowledge.
Well, excuse me.
I'm hoping that answers your question.
Aren't they under supervision?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they need to be under supervision, and I guess what I find really disagreeable about this bill is here we go again telling all the boards what they're supposed to be regulating when why we have boards is to regulate it. As a psychologist, now retired, I don't practice any longer, I had lots of coursework in suicide prevention and a host of other topics and supervised people regarding those issues. Frankly, pain management has changed since my early training. I'd be obsolete. I'd have to go back and do some makeup. But I just think this bill is the very thing we've been trying to work towards not doing. And I just thought we ought to put that right out here early on.
All right, save that for the discussion.
Thank you. Ann, I was just wondering if you could explain the difference between the bill that passed the Senate as amended and then the -4. And I see in the -4, part of it is to facilitate the development of a statewide strategic youth suicide intervention and prevention plan, which is what you've been doing. Is it that you need an extension? I just want to understand the proposed amendment.
I think Dr. Rickard, what do you want to follow that again?
Well, it sounds like the one that you're talking about is yet to be on OLIS, because there's nothing to do. That's a whole new use this relating to clause, right? But I'm just going to the proposed -4 that is on OLIS. that deletes a bunch and adds a bunch, and I just wondered if you could describe it. I'm not sure where it came from, if it came from you, but
yes,
if you could describe.
It was requested by the health authority.
The original bill, yes, was our draft.
Okay. So you describe the original, not the original, but the one that passed over, the one that was the amended, that passed over from the Senate to us, and then the amendment, the proposed amendment.
The proposed, the body of the bill is the same. It's a voluntary program, uh-huh. and that's what passed the Senate. And what this does is require the licensing boards to promulgate rules and requires them to report their, keep statistics and report their statistics to OHA.
You're talking about the amendment now?
The amendment, yes. Uh-huh. This
so
amendment.
Adding a reporting piece.
Adding the reporting piece. And the bill is incorporated into the ORS that was passed in 2014 to create our youth suicide prevention plan. Mm-hmm. So the decision was made to put this into that statute. Is that mm-hmm. clear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it seems like this is adding that language.
Yeah. It extends the continuing education piece into the existing law. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me thank this panel. Let's suspend this hearing for a moment and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 485A for the purpose of calling Senator Pruzanski to the stand. And Sandy, what do we have in this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 485 comes to you at chief sponsor, Senator Floyd Pruzanski. It exempts nonprofit corporations from Oregon's corporate practice of medicine law if specific federal certification requirements are met and the entity provides services to migrant, rural, homeless, or other medically underserved populations. Mr. Chair, this has no revenue. It has a minimal fiscal impact. Left the Senate floor, 29 ayes, one excused, and I believe Mr. Alexander has joined Senator Pruzanski, and that is our panel, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, did you want to have Oliver speak later? I know you're taking
it
this
would
for me.
I prefer that because I'm going to lose part of the committee.
No, I understand.
I didn't mean to.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to put a few words on the record. My name is Floyd Pruzanski, State Senator from District 4 and representing parts of Lane and Douglas County, and my endeavors as the senator. Oak Ridge is a community that's not only in my district, but also in Vice Chair Cedric Hayden's district. Representative Hayden and I have had an opportunity to work with Oliver Alexander, who is going to be presenting later to you. I'm here just to let you know that this is an opportunity for us to allow for these entities to actually be in existence in rural communities and deliver rural health care to many individuals that are not able to get that in their own community and are forced to travel some distance. And specifically in the case of Orchid Healthcare that has a facility in Oak Ridge. They service people within the Oak Ridge, West Fur, and other greater areas around those two communities. Normally, with those individuals that live in those communities would have to go would be into the Eugene-Springfield area to gain access to medical care. And as you can imagine, for many of them, it's virtually impossible for them to do so and to be on any type of regular basis and having preventive care. Oliver Alexander and his partner were two young men at the business school in University of Oregon. This was their project that they took on in their endeavor, and they have committed themselves to the point of where they've actually have shown how they can deliver these services to rural communities successfully and ensure that those communities actually have what I call immediate access to health care on a preventive and routine type of basis of information that, procedures that they need. One of the things I think is important to show how they've gone, and you'll hear from Mr. Alexander, that their model has been accepted not only in Oak Ridge, but also they've now established a facility in Escada. And so I hope that you will give consideration to what he has to say. This is a means that we can ensure that many individuals, constituents of mine, as well as Representative Hayden, will be able to maintain the medical care they currently are getting through Orchid Healthcare. And I understand that they've expanded it not only just to primary health care, but also some dental services as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions, Senator? You want to make a brief comment at this point?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, thank you for continuing to work on this bill. I know this has been kind of going through the process for a while, and I'm trying to, maybe you're not the right person to ask, but there was a question, if you go back 2015, 2016, I think, about the for-profit versus the nonprofit. It seems to be geared more towards nonprofit now, but what is the exemption for the for-profit?
I would need to throw a lifeline for that one because
okay,
I think Mr. Alexander will be able to give you a little bit more information. I can tell the committee that over the endeavors of the work from the last 2 years and then specifically during this session, the Oregon Medical Association has in fact been in counsel with Mr. Alexander. They reached the conclusion as to the language that's used that everyone is on board unless something has changed since it's left the Senate. My understanding that everyone agrees that they've taken care of crossing the T's, dotting the I's to ensure that we're not going to be having unintended consequences. I know the chair in this the committee had some reservations previously. I believe those have been addressed, and Vice Chair Hayden, I believe also they had been addressed to your satisfaction. So I think we have this opportunity to move away from where we required physician-owned establishments to a different model that will, in fact, provide the services that we need in rural areas where we aren't able to have physician-owned facilities at any degree in nature. That's the problem that you'll hear from the history for Oak Ridge as to have on again and off again medical services because they just couldn't have a provider there as necessary.
I wanted to make sure we weren't dotting the T's and crossing the I's.
Okay.
I think we may be there. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. May I be excused? I was wondering if I could be excused to go back to committee.
Oh, please.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're a senator. You can go where you want.
I'm in the house of the house.
All right. We'll leave this hearing open as well. Do some work sessions while we still have members of the committee. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 743A. Madam Administrator.
743.
Where are you, sir?
Right.
No, 743A.
Yes,
she did.
Back.
Yes,
he
did.
Yes, he did. That's right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 743A had a public hearing on May 3rd. You'll remember this creates a violation for a retail sale of dextromethorphan, otherwise known as DXM, to individuals under the age of 18, requires businesses and their employees to verify whether an individual attempting to purchase DXM is 18 years of age or older, establishes fines for the individual or the business that sells DMX to an individual that is underage, allows the law enforcement to enforce violations, and it requires trade associations that represent the manufacturers of the over-the-counter finished drug products containing DXM to provide any requesting businesses that makes the retail sales with a list of the finished products that contain DXM, prohibits local municipalities from enacting ordinances regulating retail products that contain DXM beyond the regulations created by this act. Mr. Chair, there's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and I have no amendment, Mr. Chair.
Can I have a motion, please?
Chair Greenlick, I would like to move Senate Bill 743A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is it Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 743A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Guyer.
Aye.
Representative Bueller.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative
Hack. Excuse.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Greenlight.
Aye. Motion carries. 743A is on its way to the floor. A carrier. Senator Alonzo Leon, would you like this one?
Sure, but it looks like Rep. Malmstrom raised her
who's
hand.
Is that your bill?
No, it's not my bill.
No. I'll take it.
We're just ready to spread it around.
Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 743A. Open the work session on Senate Bill 754A. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 754A comes to you at the request of Senator Steiner Hayward. This had a public hearing on April 24th. You'll recall this increases the minimum age to purchase and possess tobacco and nicotine products from 18 to 21 years of age, establishes a set of fines ranging from $250 to $1,000 for individuals or businesses that distribute or sell tobacco-related products or inhalant delivery systems to persons under 21 years of age, modifies the statutory definition of cigarettes to include inhalant devices and products not approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, expands the type of facilities not permitted to allow a person under 21 years of age to possess tobacco or an inhalant delivery system when on facility grounds to include colleges, community colleges, universities, career schools, and technical education schools. Applies to conduct occurring on or after January 1, 2018. There is a revenue statement issued and a fiscal statement that are up on OLIS, Mr. Chair.
I would like to put on the record, there's been some questions raised. Representative Kemmer asked me and others have asked a question about, does this bill prohibit people 18, 19, and 20 from selling tobacco in convenience stores and like places? On the record, the answer is it does not. It does prohibit 18, 19, and 20-year-olds from working in smoke shops. That's the only limitation, and there are a few of those in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to thank you for clarifying that and putting that on the record, because it had been raised as what we thought was a legitimate concern and apparently is not.
Good. Can I have a motion on this, please?
Chair Greenlick, I would like to move Senate Bill 754A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 754A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes. Yeah,
there's a few.
Several down here. We have Representative Alonzo Leon, Kenny Geyer, and Hayden. But you have my pen.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. So first I want to say that I support this bill very much, because I want to make sure that we improve the health of our young Oregonians. However, I've heard concerns from some folks around an issue that I think is really important to consider. You know, there's concerns that are Latino and African American young men sometimes can be approached by police officers for whatever reason, and that this could potentially increase that opportunity. And I wanted to be transparent about this and share this concern, because I think it is a concern. We certainly don't want, we know that this is not a non-punitive bill for young people, but I think that the issue is very valid that I bring up, that it could potentially give police officers another reason to search young African-American and Latino or young people of color. And so I just wanted to make sure that I brought that up, that that is a concern that's been brought to my attention.
We would hope we're going to be doing away with that over time, but it's still a very real problem.
That's right.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things just in response to that, because I didn't know what you would be saying. I do know, having worked on the tobacco taxation bill with Oregon Health Equity Alliance, a couple of years ago, that there was very strong support for that because of tobacco advertisers and sellers really targeting low-income communities of color, given that those populations disproportionately smoke. And that was a really big concern, is the disproportionate amount of smoking. And I think anything that we can do to try to prevent that I do want to reemphasize that while anytime anyone is subject to racial profiling, it's abhorrent, and we should understand that and prevent it. I want to reiterate that there is no fine for youth. There'd be no reason to be stopped to see if you have a cigarette on you, because this bill does not make it against the law for them to smoke. It makes it against the law for the selling of it. The other thing that I was going to, the original reason I put my hand up is that I believe the summary is a little bit incorrect in that it says it's fines from 250 up. Actually, on page 2, line 7, the lowest fine is $50. So the summary, ideally, someone will take a look at that and confirm.
I think the $50 fine is for the seller and the $250 fine is for the owner, I think.
Yeah.
I'll make a correction.
Yeah. It's just the range of fees start at $50, not at $250.
Exactly. Okay. Any other discussion?
Representative Hayden has.
I thought you crossed it out. Representative Hayden, are you still on?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. The intent behind this bill, I strongly support. I've been a healthcare provider for 23 years and have spent 23 years talking about the consequences and the negative outcomes of tobacco use. Having said that, the process we go through here for bills either to move through the floor without additional funding or not has this bill in a position that it will reduce or eliminate services on the financial impact statement that is available on OLIS for you, the ODOT Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Program, the OHA Non-Medicaid Mental Health Programs, and the OHA Public Health Programs related to tobacco prevention and cessation. So I'm going to be a no vote because I'm also a health care provider that works in that arena significantly. I am very, very concerned about the little bit of money that we have for ride services for our disabled population and our seniors that can no longer pass a driver's test. They need to go to the doctor. They need to go to the grocery store. They need to go to bingo. And I'm concerned about that. So my hope is that my opposition to this bill will bring light to that in this bill, and we backfill those programs. I've also placed this as a vote explanation as a healthcare provider of why I will be voting no, so it will be available on OLIS and a vote explanation on the floor. Thank you.
I can also say that I have heard, this cannot be official yet, but I have heard that we've been assured there will be a special source of funds to make up the loss in revenue.
I'm hoping to push that forward.
That remains a part of the Ways and Means process,
Yes, agreed.
Could you call the roll, please?
Representative
Kennedy.
Aye.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Trina.
Aye.
Representative
Malmstrom. Aye.
Representative Pack.
Excuse, and we'll give her a chance to vote when she comes back.
Vice Chair Nose?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
No.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Vile will carry it on the floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 754 and open a work session on Senate Bill 46. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 46 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. We had a public hearing on April 26. This bill does one thing. It moves the references to the Public Employee Benefit Board, PEB, and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board from the Oregon Insurance Code to the PEB and OWEB in individual chapters. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair, and no amendment.
We have a motion?
Sure. Chair Greenlee, I'd like to move that we send Senate Bill 46 Send Senate Bill 46 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves. I was just trying to think about whether we wanted to put it on the consent calendar, but I think not. Senator Nose. Representative Nose moves. Senate Bill, you got demoted. Senate Bill 46 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Or demoted.
Is there any discussion on Senate Bill 46? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Kennedy.
Aye.
Representative Hughes.
Yes.
Representative
Orangeli. Aye.
Representative Kennedy.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom?
Aye.
Representative Hatch?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Nose?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Yes.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion carries. I have a volunteer for the floor.
Sure.
Representative Nose, is that a volunteer?
I volunteer.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 46. Open a work session on Senate Bill 332A. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 332A comes to you at the request of Nationwide Insurance. Paul Cosgrove had a public hearing on the bill May 1st. You'll recall this allows insurers to offer certain rebates with an aggregate value that does not exceed $100 in a calendar year to insureds other than persons for whom the insurer issues a health insurance plan or a health benefit plan. There is no revenue impact, Mr. Chair, no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There is no amendment before you. And again, this left the Senate floor 28 ayes, one no, and one excused.
Can I have a motion, please?
Chair Greenlee, I would like to move Senate Bill 332A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 332A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny
Geyer. Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo
Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenneman.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Excuse.
Vice Chair
Nose? Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Yes.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kenneman, will you carry this one?
Surely.
Work session closed on Senate Bill 332A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 367A. No, I'm not ready, sorry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 367A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 831A. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 831A comes to you at the request of the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. We had a public hearing on the bill May 3rd. This allows licensed podiatric physicians to supervise physician assistant. It expands the definition of supervisor physician to include podiatric physicians. No revenue impact, Mr. Chair. Minimal impact. No amendment before us. Just left the Senate floor. 30 ayes.
May I have a motion, please?
Chair Greenlee, I would like to move Senate Bill 831A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 831A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny
Geyer. Aye.
Representative
Buehler. Yes. Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenneman. Aye. Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative
Hatch.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry Senate Bill 831A and close the work session on Senate Bill 831A. Do we have one yet?
Let's see.
Oh, yes. Okay. No.
No. You just need to make an announcement.
Yeah, we'll carry over Senate Bill 367A. It has an amendment coming. Do we have all the rest of them except the ones that are in public hearing?
That 743, 831. I believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll need to keep, I hope we'll have six members here when Representative Hack comes back. We'll need six to suspend the rules, is that right?
That's right, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
We've got 4 minutes.
We have two open hearings. Let's take the one witness on Senate Bill 485A.
Okay. Okay. That was Mr. Alexander, yes?
Go for it.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Hayden, and members of the committee. My name is Oliver Alexander, and I'm here today to advocate for the passage of SB 485. 4 years ago, my business partner and I founded Orchid Health, and what we seek to do is provide extremely high-quality primary and acute care to rural areas in Oregon. Since our founding, we've opened two clinics, the first one in Oak Ridge in August of 2014, the second one in Estacada in August of 2016, and we've also created 20 rural jobs. Additionally, we now care for over 3,000 patients between those two areas. Of our patient panel, about 65% is Medicaid, about 20% is Medicare, and the rest are commercial or free care to school-based patients. Data shows that over 130,000 rural Oregonians lack local health care access, so this is the problem we set out to solve. And when local access isn't available, the fact is that rural residents suffer much higher rates of physical, psychological, and addiction issues. To put a number to that, in Oak Ridge, the rate of depression is 4 times the state average. It's easy to discuss the different issues at hand in terms of numbers of rural patients without care and different conditions, but I wanted to put it into perspective by giving the story of a couple of our patients. Last week, one of our patients established care with us in Estacada, who is about 55 years old. This patient was born with pre-existing conditions and has had over 70 surgeries in their life. This patient received multiple blood transfusions over the years and was having recurring immune deficiency problems. We tested for and diagnosed with HIV. Additionally, we've had patients who are on the fringe of being able to be seen in really any medical setting. For instance, we had a 16-year-old patient present at the clinic to establish care. Parents are undocumented. She is undocumented. Parents won't support her in her pregnancy, and she had no insurance either. We helped coordinate that patient's OHP enrollment and the successful delivery of her child. I really don't think that there's any doubt about the problems in rural Oregon and the massive challenges it takes to solve those problems. I don't think that there's any doubt that there's a shortage of providers willing to tackle this issue and really understand the issue at its core. But even though there are those problems, I think there is undoubtedly hope, and we are happy to provide hope to our current patients and the future patients in rural areas across Oregon that we hope to serve. So I ask that you pass Senate Bill 485 out of committee, and I'm happy to help answer questions that you may have regarding the bill specifically.
Are there any questions for Ms. Kenny Geyers?
I do. Thank you. So can you just explain the basis of the bill, that you can't start a health clinic unless you're a physician with a voting? Like, I don't get that part.
Sure.
What's the barrier that you're trying to overcome here?
In order to provide medical services in Oregon, you have to be majority owned and directed by a licensed Oregonian physician, so they must own at least 51% of the shares of the company. So in order to comply with this and to get the clinic open in Oak Ridge, we found a physician who was willing to own 51% of the company. We then created a second company and subcontracted out management to both comply with the law but also maintain control and establish our company. So with that structure, we do comply with the law, but it's a very outdated law. Oregon's law is about 30 years old on average, and just like most of the states, it's over 30 years old on average as well. The problem is that
way older than that, I think, in this case.
Yeah, it's definitely an archaic law in our opinion. The issue is that with this physician, who's essentially a placeholder so that we can comply with the law, he participates minimally. We have a separate medical director who has 20 years of experience and works full-time for us. This physician just serves to fix that issue. Therefore, they're not willing to sign on financing when we need it. For instance, we wanted a new x-ray. Obviously, we don't have $70,000 cash, so we wanted to have that and finance it, couldn't get that. So we're just constantly impeded by our lack of ability to get bank financing. When Trillium was purchased, they went through a massive software change that led to our receivables getting put out 3 months, just totally unexpectedly, put us on the brink of insolvency. So these type of issues are just constant, and it's really difficult, A, to provide rural health care, and B, to overcome such severe business issues as well. So we just need the lifeline of being able to go to a bank and get a line of credit and just operate like any traditional business would in that regard. And the key aspect of the bill is that this is changing that ownership structure to allow for-profits to do that. So currently, nonprofits are already able to do this. But when we formed the company, we went as a for-profit purposefully. And that's for two reasons. One, if you depend on grants to finance expansion and to operate the company on a long-term basis. You know, changes in administration, budget issues can lead to those grants drying up completely, as well as if you see a grant that is appealing and you apply for it and you wait 6 months and you're building a program in the meantime, then you don't get it, and now the progress is essentially stopped completely. So we didn't like the idea of participating at the whim of grants. And second off, the company was founded through the Oregon Social Business Challenge in 2012. The idea was to solve a social problem, but do it in a financially sustainable way to show that some of society's most pressing issues can be solved while turning a profit. And so that's a core value for ours, is showing that these problems that we face are worth examining very closely and are worth creating a solution for, which is what we'd like to think we've done.
Follow up.
Yeah.
So thank you. And we had another bill that kind of addressed this in terms of nurse practitioners and others being able to have ownership. So if both these go forward, because this is just saying physicians don't need to have 51%, right?
This is for certified rural health clinics only.
Just for certified rural.
And this is a specific niche to rural areas. I'd prefer not to speak on the nurse practitioner PA bill. It's a bit outside of my realm. But for rural Oregon, there's a massive problem, and it takes innovative solutions, which we're ready to provide if this bill can go through.
Okay. Where is the camera?
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say, as a rep who represents Escada, I appreciate you being out there. It is a high-need community and low income and somewhat of a rural setting close to the suburban area, and just glad to see you there.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. Glad to help you get there.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your patience. It's been a long ride. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 485A and schedule it for, say, next Monday for a work session. We'll have the whole committee here for that.
Thank you very much.
Can I have a motion to suspend the rules so Representative Hack can vote on a few bills?
Chair Greenleg, I would like to make a motion that the committee suspend its rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Hack to vote on bills that were passed when she was not president of committee.
Representative Nose moves that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Hack to vote. Hearing no objection, so moved. Representative Hack, let me ask first, how do you vote on Senate Bill 754A?
I will be a no. And I'd like to give a brief explanation, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
I had the intent of being a yes, but after some further review, I have some concerns about our inability to change the clear meaning of a statute by a statement of legislative intent. If you look at the OLCC rules, it's clear in statute that those who are 18 to 21 years old can sell beer and wine, but it's not clear in our statutes in this piece of legislation about the meaning of selling of the tobacco in, say, a 7-Eleven or so forth. There is a ruling, PGE versus Boley, that clarifies that exact issue. Until I can get that cleared up, I'll be a no.
I did put on the record a statement clarifying that.
Clarifying in the other direction.
Saying that for the record that it is clear that the statute does not prevent people 18, 19, and 20 from working in convenience stores and grocery stores.
Is that by stating it by legislative intent, or is it actually going to be in statute?
Legislative intent.
Because the clarification that I had gotten was that there is a case out there, PGE versus Boley, that they had that exact issue, and it was stated by legislative intent, and then there was a ruling in PGE versus Boley that said no legislative intent can overrule the clear meaning of a statute.
Well, there is nothing in the clear meaning of a statute that prevents it from happening. So it's to clear it up in case, I mean, the clear meaning of the statute, if there was any ambiguity, then the legislative intent would.
Okay. I'll stay a no until I can kind of do a little more research there, but for now, so I may change my mind between now and the floor.
Well, we heard the no on Senate Bill 754.
Thank
you,
sir.
Let me ask how you vote on Senate Bill 46.
Aye.
Senate Bill 332A.
Aye.
Senate Bill 367. No, I'm sorry, not that one.
743.
Senate Bill 743A.
Aye.
Aye.
And Senate Bill 831A.
Aye.
Close the work session. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, let's go to the public. Let's finish the public hearing now on Senate Bill. Which one?
48.
Senate Bill 48, will you call? There were three more witnesses, I
believe? Yes, Mr. Chair. We had Cheryl Ramirez, Rachel Wiggins, Emery, and Courtney Dressel.
Thank you all for being patient while we try to move some bills along.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Nuss, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Ramirez, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and in my role as facilitator and member of the Alliance to Prevent Suicide. This is a group that represents health and other systems, people who are suicide attempt survivors, and family members of people who have attempted or have died by suicide. We support Senate Bill 48, although we are disappointed in the change from a CEU requirement to being permissive in this amendment. We wouldn't ever expect CPR to be an elective, and so why don't we have the same expectations for suicide prevention? We believe that health professionals should be trained early on in their education to detect suicide risk and treat people who are at risk for suicide. Nevertheless, we do appreciate the requirements for the boards to encourage health professionals to complete continuing education and suicide risk assessment, treatment and management, and the requirement for Oregon Health Authority to track and report these CEUs. And Senate Bill 48 will certainly test the effectiveness of a voluntary program. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and committee members. My name is Rachel Wiggins Emery, here on behalf of Oregon Society of Physician Assistants and the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations for Counseling and Therapy. We are here in opposition to Senate Bill 48, which would place onerous and expensive reporting burdens on the licensing board, as well as potentially requiring practitioners to add a new continuing education program to their already robust continuing education requirements. We intimately understand the need for suicide risk assessment and prevention in mental, behavioral, and primary care health, but believe this bill offers an ultimately onerous solution. We are opposed because mandating continuing education requirements are not a meaningful way to reduce suicide rates. What would reduce those rates is a greater capacity in the healthcare profession to provide mental health and psychiatric services in Oregon. We need more psychiatric facilities, more mental health providers, more alcohol and drug treatment centers, not more continuing education. Section 1 of this bill places a large reporting burden on boards, and as they are funded with fees from providers, we expect that either licensing fees will rise or staff time will be taken from other important board services. While the Dash 4 amendment does remove the requirement for practitioners to report completion of that continuing education, this bill still allows boards to require documentation from their members through rule, while also requiring those boards to report utilization and completion data. This is concerning to us as we have no professional full-time staff, and this leaves this responsibility to volunteers and adds an additional burden to providers who may still be required to submit documentation to the boards. Additionally, with the high costs related to collection, management, and reporting of the data, we are concerned that there would be an increase in fees passed along to members and ultimately to the patients accessing care to pay for this mandate. We shared these concerns with the Senate Committee on Human Services, and the Dash-A4 amendment does nothing to address or alleviate them. Finally, Section 1, Subsection 4 and 5 require boards to encourage their members to complete the outlined continuing education while also allowing them to add to or replace current continuing education requirements with this training. We are concerned that this inadvertently puts boards into a position of having to require the completion of the suicide risk assessment continuing education in order to meet the requirements of the bill, forcing their members to forego other continuing education requirements or add on another. We respectfully urge the committee to vote no on this bill, as it replaces an extensive and onerous burdens on the smaller professional associations and licensing boards. to collect and manage and report data, as well as potentially requiring practitioners to add a new continuing education program without truly addressing the serious need around suicide prevention. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association. I wanted to just first say that we're thankful for the Oregon Health Authority for bringing this forward and this issue forward, and also for working with us to remove the mandate on CME, as you've heard that can be a burdensome on all the different providers, including physicians, and not always so successful in the true issue is trying to achieve. If the bill moves forward, we do hope that the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Medical Board and all the boards will be thoughtful about what is reportable and the cost of the reporting requirements for the boards. In particular, on the part about what is reportable, it's possible that a provider could take a CME on something that may not have the word suicide in it, but still have training as part of that CME that includes maybe throughout the CME about different suicide prevention assessments and mental health issues, and just making sure that we figure out how we would report that if it's not necessarily a approved CME on suicide prevention. So we're just trying to figure out how that would all work and making sure that it's not too much of a burden on our providers to figure out what's reportable, what's not, and all those type of things. So we hope that the Oregon Health Authority and the boards will work closely together to figure this piece out.
Are you supporting the bill at this point?
We're neutral on the bill as it is right now. We hope that there, again, we are very appreciative that there's no mandate.
Thank you. Are there any questions of this panel?
I do.
Please.
Thank you, Chair. This is such an important issue. I don't think any one of us could dispute that fact. I'm just wondering if we might be able to hear from the agency about some of the concerns raised by Courtney, maybe about, you know, what the requirements will be. Is anybody here from the agency that we might?
And we have the medical board that can put some comments on the record as well.
They've asked to make a comment, so we'll get the board.
Okay.
And Rep. Kenemer.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. I wanted to thank the professional counselors. That, you know, I guess to me as a former mental health practitioner, these kinds of issues are fundamental to the beginnings and of training, and extensive training, I might add. And I just find it reprehensible that we're going to mandate this stuff. I think in this committee, we've been increasingly working towards holding our boards responsible for setting this standards for continuing education and for determining what areas people are competent to practice in, and that they practice within the limits of their training and their skills. And incidentally, that varies. There are those who work in situations where they frequently see suicide. There are those who see it very rarely. I just find this a very disagreeable bill, well-intended, believe me. But, you know, as a former professional, if I supervised people, I had responsibility to make sure that they were competent to properly diagnose and to provide appropriate treatment or appropriate referrals. This is over-regulation. This adds new requirements. I mean, for some physicians and psychiatrists and psychologists, social workers, professional counselors, who frankly deal with suicidal issues on a daily, almost daily basis, this is absurd. And sorry to be so strong, but I find this bill extraordinarily well-intended. We do not want, we realize early intervention is very important. Good intervention is essential, and it's not always there. But this kind of mandate is window dressing and fluff, and adds costs and trouble. And I'm getting the message. It's time to shut up. But I
you're going to be a curmudgeon.
Well, it's the first time I've been called that for a while.
Thank you. Okay.
Can I call the medical board?
Yes, would you? Can we get the medical board? Thank you very much.
Would Nicole from the Oregon Medical Board, please?
I don't know.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Krishnaswamy. I'm the Operations and Policy Analyst for the Oregon Medical Board. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 48. The board has no position on this bill, but we're happy to provide factual information to the committee and on what this bill means to the boards and to our licensees, and then what efforts the boards are already putting toward suicide prevention. So this is a very important issue, obviously, and one that the board cares very deeply about, as evidenced by our primary focus on that in our coming biennium. Our budget has allocated significant funds toward establishing wellness programs throughout the state for all of our physicians and physician assistants to ensure that we are doing as much as we can for our professionals. The board is also uniquely positioned to engage directly with over 20,000 licensed providers in our state, and we would be able to provide educational materials and resources to them through our newsletter, our biennial license renewal reminders, and their renewal certificates, our website, and we would be happy to report on those efforts to you as well.
I believe suicide is an issue among your licensees as well as
It is a significant clients. Issue among our licensees as well as the public, yes.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for coming on board. And so I just have a quick question around, so we have 20,000 physicians, right, you mentioned. How many of them actually have this training already? Not your information, but actually have this training already?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Alonso Leon, thank you. We have approximately 16,000 physicians. That 20,000 number includes physician assistants and acupuncturists, okay, which we also license and regulate. It's unclear to me how many have received extensive education in suicide prevention. We could provide numbers on the number of specialists who are in psychiatric care or primary care, but I believe that that's already a part of their 4 to 5 year residency and fellowship programs in those specialties.
Follow up. So that's part of the education for the segment of physicians, but I'm asking, I guess, in general, do you guys track either certification or physicians who have gotten this level of training on suicide prevention?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Alonso Leon, we are not tracking the level of detail that this bill would require us to track. We do monitor who is board certified, and as part of their board certification, maintenance of certification, they do have to obtain CME that's relevant to their practice, and their certifying boards may require very specific CME. We require that the CME they obtain is relevant to their practice. So if they were practicing in mental health care, primary care, this would absolutely be relevant to their practice, and we would allow that as part of their maintenance of licensure.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hack, did you have any further questions?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 423. Madam
Minister. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 423 comes to you at the request of the Senate Health Senator Steiner Hayward on behalf of Zoom Plus Care. This had this permits physician assistants to dispense Schedule 3 and 4 drugs under the Federal Controlled Substance Act. This takes effect January 1, 2018. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair. This left the Senate floor with 26 ayes, 3 noes. And we have 4 people signed up, Mr. Chair.
Can you call the first count?
We have Len Bergstein. Albert, do you know his last name? I can't read it. DePierre? Okay, and then Nick? Mick? Sorry, gentlemen. You must be doctors. Yes.
Ouch.
Well, no.
Can't read their handwriting.
Huh? I used to be able to read doctor's writing.
Fortunately, Len's not a doctor.
And his was the only one I could read well.
I'm happy about that. I'll tell my family that my handwriting passed.
Mr. Bergstein.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thanks very much. My name is Len Bergstein. I'm here representing Zoom Plus Care, and we're here to speak in support of Senate Bill 423. With me also, and probably you're more interested in hearing from Dr. DiPiero, who is the co-founder of Zoom Plus Care and is also the director of the medical operations, and then also Dr. Thad Mick, who runs our operations dealing with medications. 423 is a kind of a modest but meaningful bill, we think, to reform state policy to allow physician assistants under strict supervision to dispense certain prescription medicines that are currently identified as Category 3 and 4, as your staff mentioned. They're controlled substances. But this bill would solve the problem that it would allow them to dispense regardless of whether they provide care in urban or rural settings. There are objectives to this, and I've kind of listed them in my testimony, so I won't go through them now, and you'll hear from those again. The bill enjoyed broad bipartisan support in the Senate. We've discussed with, Nicole Krishnaswamy at the Oregon Medical Board about whether this could be done by rule, and she thought that this was better brought as a statutory change. As you can see in my testimony, there is some conflict in the statutes between rural and urban PAs, and that's the problem or the barrier, Representative Kenny Guyer, that we kind of come to you for to try and solve in this case. So let's get into the underlying policy here. We're happy to talk also about an amendment if you are going to talk about that today, but we want to talk directly to the underlying policy of the bill.
Is there an amendment coming?
There's a question about whether Chair Greenlick about whether it solves the problem or not. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here. My name is Albert DiPiero. I'm the co-founder of Zoom Care and the chief medical officer, and I'm a practicing primary care general internist. And I am here to explain how allowing physician assistants to dispense certain Category 3 and 4 controlled substances fits into sound, safe, and appropriate medical practice. You have my written testimony, so if it's okay, maybe I'll just hit on a few highlights of that this afternoon. Zoom Care is an integrated delivery system with 25 clinics in the Portland metro area, and we're staffed by physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners. Zoom is built on a model
in my district, I believe.
I'm sorry?
You're headquartered in my district, I believe.
Yes, we are, our new headquarters. And Zoom's model is built on a concept of on-demand healthcare with extended hours in neighborhoods in the Portland metro area. And we really pioneered the deployment of physician assistants as the primary deliverers of quality frontline care. We have 40 PAs, physician assistants on staff at Zoom. And really a core principle of this model is enabling patients to leave the clinic with their acute medications in hand. So SB 423 would enable Zoom Care physician assistants to dispense really two key common medicines that are just part of primary care and urgent care, and that's tramadol for pain and pseudoephedrine for sinus and nasal congestion. Enabling the dispensing of these medicines in clinic would really accomplish greater convenience for patients, increase speed to treatment. We think it would actually improve the safety and quality of care, and it would ensure, as Lena alluded to, consistency in dispensing rules throughout Oregon. We've worked closely with the Oregon Medical Board to develop a structure for safety and oversight for physician assistants, and since the very beginning, Zoom Care has created a training and monitoring program for physician assistants that we think is really the best in class right now. I wrote out the six core points of that program, but I'll just highlight here that all of the care that the PAs dispense, all the care that they deliver, including the dispensing of medicines, is really done under detailed protocols that we've developed and we enforce. And then finally, Zoom Care Urgent Cares do not dispense or prescribe opioids or benzodiazepines. That's including our physicians, PAs, NPs. We don't dispense or prescribe those medicines. So this bill, SB 423, would really have the key practical effect of allowing our key frontline providers to dispense pseudoephedrine and tramadol. And that's why I'm speaking here in support of this bill and think that this would be a modest, safe, but really key part of primary and urgent care. So thank you for your time tonight.
I thought I remembered we had made pseudoephedrine category two.
I'm sorry?
I thought I remembered we had made pseudoephedrine category two. Am I misremembering that?
It's a category three pseudoephedrine.
Requires a written prescription? Yes. Yeah.
So thank you, and I'll turn it over to Thad.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Thad Mick. I'm filling in for Larry Cartier, who's our chief pharmacist. You have his testimony before you, but if you would allow me, I'd like to submit some additional points on the testimony that was submitted to you. Under the current statute, dispensing privileges of certain controlled medications are granted to physician's assistants based on their geographic location or the population they served. And it is not based on the PA's training, their licensure, or their clinical competence. SB 423 simply eliminates this geographic variability in practice standards and will allow PAs to perform the same duties regardless of where the practice setting is in Oregon. As a pharmacist in Zoom Care, my focus is to ensure the clinical and therapeutic outcomes are improved through the appropriate use of medication. Within each of our Zoom Care clinics, we stock common medications on site, allowing them to be available for dispensing during the patient's visit. As a pharmacist, I am all too familiar with national studies that demonstrate time and time again that up to one-third of all prescriptions written by healthcare professionals are not filled by the patients. There are numerous factors that contribute to this. However, commonly cited issues include cost, patient confusion, and simply inconvenience. Zoom Care has fought to solve this problem. Excuse me. Has fought to solve this problem, and we believe our model and patient care will deliver on this. I thank you for the opportunity to present this information.
Is the issue that we were talking about the amendment, whether we need an amendment for the pharmacy prescribing monitoring?
Chair Greenlick, the question was reporting that was raised. We have stated time and again that we voluntarily report, and we would report these. If you have another question about that, the Board of Pharmacy has a specific set of rules regarding supervising physician dispensing outlets, and we believe that we fall under those categories. But we are willing to voluntarily report because we understand it's important policy. We don't think we need a statute for that.
Yes.
Well, and if I may interject, with the discussions that Mr. Bernstein and I have been having with Ledge Council, they issued a memo. The memo is up on OLA's, and it specified that if drafting this amendment requiring the supervisory entity to report to the PDMP, the amendment would be setting a precedence, because right now the reporting from the PDMP occurs at the pharmacy.
From the PBMB or to the PBMB?
I'm sorry.
Putting material into the monitoring system.
The pharmacy is the one that submits the data to the prescription drug monitoring program, not the subscribers. And so
not the prescribers.
Right, not the person writing the prescription. They don't report. It's the pharmacy. So we have a memo that outlines the current process of what that is, and then we haven't completed an accurate amendment because we were going to have the discussion here at the meeting today.
But the question is, do these dispensing get into the monitoring system now.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Zoom uses a commercial dispensing system, so our system is already, it would be reporting automatically into the drug database. Into the monitoring system.
It would automatically put the data in.
Yes, that's the system we use today does that.
So you're serving, in this case, the role that a pharmacy would be serving at that point in the...
Chair Greenlick, I'm not sure I'd qualify it that way as serving as a role of a pharmacy, but we're definitely reporting. We're doing the reporting.
I mean, the question is, category 3 and 4 drugs need to get into the monitoring system, and they would as a part of your process under this?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, that's correct.
Do they currently in the rural areas get into the monitoring system?
Within pharmacies, yes, they do.
I mean, you have the ability to, you don't have any rural clinics out there.
We do not have any clinics that are designated as rural clinics today.
Good. Okay. Are there any other questions in the panel? We'll need to figure this one out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. We have one more person, Mr. Chair. Bill Cross.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And we are neutral on the bill, but we are concerned about the reporting of level 3 and 4 drugs to the PDMP. We think that should occur, and right now there isn't a requirement. The requirement is that pharmacies report. And so we're supportive of a concept that would say that these Speedos is what they're referred to in the pharmacy world, but as organizations, they would be added to OHA's requirements to comply with reporting information when they dispense a level 3 or 4
drug. What happens now in the rural areas is the ability to dispense category 3 and 4, right? By nurse practitioners and by PAs, I assume, as well, although I suppose it's mostly nurse practitioners. Do they get into the PBBM?
They do not. Huh. Most of them do not have a clinic where they're doing anything other. Most of them meet an exemption that says if you're doing up to 48 hours, and it's, you know, samples, you're trying to get them through the weekend, you're exempt. I mean, so physicians, nurse practitioners.
Nurse practitioners have the right to dispense in rural areas.
Yes, they do.
Not just 48 hours supply.
Right. But as far as the regulations go right now, they're not required to either report to the PDMP, and I believe the Board of Pharmacy is just in its final stages of creating a category called practitioner dispensing organizations. Because the Board of Pharmacy could identify the pharmacies and regulate
them. Right, they're involved in regulating them.
But it's the PDMP that regulates the organizations and not the so they regulate pharmacies, but not pharmacists. And they could regulate and require a Speedo, but they're, again, not the actual professionals who are dispensing within that organization. It would be the responsibility of the Speedo. And so in the case of ZoomCare...
Where the amendment might go, if we talk about amendment, would be to specifically deal with the Zoom situation, and then recognize we have a little gap in the pharmacy prescribing monitoring system.
Mr. Chair, I think you're...
Maybe work on that.
Mr. Chair, I think you're absolutely right. I think you could take... You have dash one amendments, and the very first section would achieve what you've just stated, and then maybe, you know, next year or when the Board of Pharmacy finalizes its rules on practitioner dispensing organizations, you fold them in the same way.
Okay. Mr. Bergstein, will you work with us on this one?
Chair Green, of course.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 423. And unless we have something further to bring before us, you all did good today. Where's your... You all did good today.